When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of This Week in History with me, your host, Dan the Viking. Joining me in this special episode today, we have historian Dr. Robert Bernstein. Now, she is the Dillon Professor of American History and Professor of African and African-American Studies and Studies of Women and Gender and Sexuality at the Harvard University. She is the author of a new book called Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a context here. So before we go into the interview, we are talking about a case in the early 1800s in America where a gentleman by the name of William Freeman was sentenced to 5 years in prison in Auburn. Now, Auburn was a new prison, it was a new style of prison, and it was the first prison for profit in American history. It's still around today, and it is still a prison for profit. The story goes that William Freeman was convicted of stealing a horse. He was sentenced to 5 years in the Auburn system. Auburn, with it being a new system, was a very brutal and horrible place to be. He denied on all courses that he did not commit this crime, but was still sentenced to 5 years. And during this time, Auburn State Prison was responsible for essentially slave labor of the prison inmates. And William Freeman, being a free man, was not happy, to say the least. During his 5 years in prison, he was not allowed to speak or look at another prisoner. Now, obviously, you can imagine the emotional stress on someone in this sort of situation. 5 years in pure solitary confinement. In fact, he even knew somebody who was in that prison with him, but he never knew he was in that prison with him until he got out. This was mainly because they weren't allowed to look or talk to people in the prison. On circumstances where prisoners were to break these rules, the guards issued physical punishment. In fact, on one occasion, William Freeman was beaten so badly that he went deaf. This was something that stayed with him for the rest of his life. When he was finally released from prison at the age of 20, he wanted reparations for the work that he'd done in that prison. He was given $2 when he left the prison, and he saw this as a payment for his 5 years service, and he believed that wasn't enough. In fact, Auburn State Prison gave every inmate $2 when they left, so they would go home and not hang around outside the prison. They had enough money to get themselves home. So that was the system. He did not believe $2 for 5 years was an acceptable amount. So he looked for back pay. he went to lawyers, he tried to do everything he could, and he was not listened to. He was laughed away, told to get lost. And because of this, instead of getting back pay, he got payback. He broke into a home and murdered three people in the home, a triple homicide. He was sentenced to death, and he died before the sentence could be carried out. But why did he do it? What was the reasons? This was black on white violence. This is not something that was publicized all the time in New York or in America in general. It wasn't something that people wanted to see. They didn't want to admit that this could happen. So why did it happen? Well, we've got Dr. Bernstein joining us today, and she has written a fantastic book about this story, and it goes into quite a lot of detail. So she's here to explain in a little bit more detail how she came across the book and where the system was failing William Freeman and how that system is still failing today. I want to welcome with us Dr. Bernstein. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. We've done a little bit of a little talk about the story. I've given a little bit of information about the prison system, how Auburn Prison, is it a state prison?
Yes.
Yeah. So Auburn State Prison, how it is now, how it was then, how the change in the American prison system back in the early 1800s and how it's worked. I've given a little bit of information about William Freeman, not too much because I don't want to give too much away. But I've done a little bit of research into this. I find this story very, very fascinating. But what I want to know about this from yourself is how you found the story, because it's so obscure and it's so different to what, you know, what I mean. I'm a historian, obviously. Yourself, you're a historian. This isn't something that we come across every day.
Well, I came across it by accident, and I think that's often how historians find their stories. I came across it while I was looking for something else, and what I found was a footnote. I found a footnote that referred to a theatrical production that happened in Auburn, New York, in 1846. Auburn is a town in central New York State in the Finger Lakes area of New York State in the U.S. And the footnote that I found astounded me, and I thought, this can't be right. This can't be correct. What was in the footnote was information about a theatrical performance in which an African-American man committed a murder of white people. And I knew, as a cultural historian, I knew that that was very, very strange, because in the mid-19th century, Americans who were white absolutely did not want to see black-on-white violence. They wanted so badly not to see black-on-white violence that they actually doctored performances of Othello to obscure the possibility of black-on-white violence. That's how much they didn't want to see this. And yet here were white people in Auburn, New York in 1846 paying to see this as the central attraction. And I thought, once I verified that this was actually correct, because at first I thought, this can't be real, this can't be right. But then once I verified that it was correct, this performance really did happen, I thought, what happened in Auburn, New York, in 1846, to make white people behave so differently from white people elsewhere in the United States? I realized that something race-shaking must have happened, and I wanted to find out what it was. So I started learning about the factual murder that was being fictionalized on screen. There was a factual murder, and the person who committed this crime was named William Freeman. And I started learning more and more about him. And what I learned was that he had committed this act of violence for a really important reason. He was challenging the original prison for profit. And that's where we get the title of my book, Freeman's Challenge, the murder that shook America's original prison for profit. That idea of shaking was right there in the initial impetus for this book, the question that started this whole investigation for me. So that is how I stumbled across it and why I realized it was important.
Yeah, I mean, I find it very, very fascinating, and like, I mean, we had a little discussion a minute ago, and I find it very strange. Like I said, I come in from Britain, and our prison systems are not prison for, we don't really. I think we've, if I'm honest with you, I believe there's a new one that's been built that is centered around making money, but our general prison system doesn't have that. I mean, we obviously our prisoners work inside the prison. But they're not in a money-making business. Whereas Auburn was sort of the first prison to take that stand and to change the system. I mean, is that a common thing in America? Is the prison for profit? Is that's quite widespread now, I'm assuming.
It's very widespread. And what's even more widespread is the philosophy behind it. So, the philosophy that was invented in Auburn was the idea that a prison can and should be a positive economic force beyond the prison itself. So, the idea that on the one hand, prisons are bad, but on the other hand, they create jobs, that idea is very widespread in the United States. That idea is foundational. And one of the things that I want to show in Freeman's Challenge is that that idea had a beginning. That idea was not always self-evident. So now it is self-evident. And even when you have a prison, an individual prison that is not aiming for profit per se, that prison is still in the United States making economic arguments, the argument that the prison will somehow benefit the local economy, that the prison is somehow good for the state, that it's good for reasons that don't have anything to do with justice, reasons that don't have anything to do really with crime. So, this idea that prisons can be economically beneficial, I would say that every single prison in the United States, in one way or another, is operating through that principle, and its birthplace was in New York State, and that is what my book is about.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned again to yourself earlier that I found it quite fascinating because this is, I mean, we're obviously here, we're talking about a black gentleman who's committed, if I'm honest with you, quite a heinous crime. You know, it is, it there's no, to me, there's no excuse for the crime. I understand the concept, and I understand what he was trying to achieve, and from reading little bits and pieces about it. He still wasn't heard, you know. Although, I mean, we go to this, you know. I mean, you talk about terrorism and things in modern days. This to me was an act of terror. But there was a motive behind the, you know, the crime itself. And at least nowadays, I mean, obviously we've had that horrific incident a few days ago, with President Trump, and these people have motives, but their motives get spoken about. We hear their motives. We know the reason behind why they've done it. So I know in this particular instance, the FBI is hiding a little bit of information on this guy. But Freeman never really got his voice, even though he was trying to make a point. His point was sort of on deaf ears. I mean, obviously, you know, obviously the story with his prosecutor, and even his own defense attorney didn't really listen to him. And I find that so strange. But then trying to take yourself back to 1800s America, it's a very different system. And I just wonder what that must have been like. And is that something that still happens in America? I mean, obviously, I know you're speciality in history is to do with race, and I just wonder, is was he not listened to because of his race, or was he not listened to because of the fact that his crime was so heinous people didn't really want to hear about it?
Well, what Freeman was saying, and first he said it with words. He said it with words long before he said it with violence. What he was saying was that profit-driven prison is wrong. What he was saying was that the state had stolen his labor, that he was a free person. He was not a slave. He was a citizen with rights. So let's kind of go back just for a moment. William Freeman was an African American and also Native American teenager who grew up right next to the Auburn State Prison. And when he was 15, he was accused of a horse theft that he swore he did not commit. And for this reason, he was incarcerated in the Auburn State Prison. The Auburn State Prison was built around factories. There were factories literally built into the prison, and these factories were run by private companies. Private companies leased the factories, and then they leased the prisoners' labor. And the prisoners received no money at all, no wages, nothing, no kind of compensation for their labor. But they were making consumer goods, which then the companies sold throughout the Northeast and in some cases throughout the United States. So companies were getting rich, the prison was making a profit off of its prisoners, and the prisoners were getting nothing. And William Freeman, as this teenager, spoke up and he said that he did not want to work for nothing, that he had the right to be paid for his labor. He had the right to benefit from his own labor because he was a free person. And he was ignored and he was laughed at. And he was also beaten terribly. There was enormous violence against him by the guards because he was pushing back against his forced servitude. So then he leaves the prison. He gets out when he's 20 years old, and he spends 6 months trying to articulate this claim against the prison. He talks about it to anyone who will listen to him, and a lot of people who don't want to listen to him, he still talks about it. And he also tries to take legal action against the prison. He tries to get magistrates to help him recover back wages, and that doesn't work either. And then finally, he resorts to violence, and that's the murder in the title of the book, Freeman's Challenge, the murder that shook America's original prison for profit. So he was speaking all along. And you're right, nobody listened. And then finally, when he spoke through violence, when he articulated his point through an act of terrorism, and you're absolutely right that that is what it was an act of terrorism. When he finally did that, at that point, nobody could laugh him off and nobody could ignore him anymore. But what they did, rather than actually grapple with the meat of what he was saying, what they did instead was make up their own stories about why William Freeman did what he did. And the reason that they were so invested in not hearing William Freeman was that Auburn was a kind of company town where the company was the prison itself. And every single person in Auburn, every single person, no matter who you were, no matter what your position was, no matter what your business was or your job was, you were somehow tied economically to the Auburn prison because it was a company town, and that's how company towns work. So everybody had a vested interest in not hearing that the economic engine at the center of their city, and by this time it had become the center of New York State, a center for economics and for economic growth, and also for politics. New York State was dependent on the Auburn State Prison. So nobody wanted to hear this, that Freeman's challenge. So what they did was they made up their own explanations for why Freeman did what they did, what he did. And the explanation that white people came up with, of course, was that Freeman committed this act of violence because of race, which was absolutely not what Freeman had ever said. But they made up this story with no evidence whatsoever. And it was a racist story that attached violence to some sort of inherent biological fan a fantasy of a racist fantasy of inherent biological violence in Black and Brown bodies. And this was a racist narrative that was at the time novel. And then in his trial, this narrative spread throughout the United States and it took hold, and it is still enormously powerful today.
Yeah, I mean, I find that, like I said, I totally understand the racism side to it, and I I've watched this is I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I don't know a huge amount about American history, obviously being from this side of the pond. My dad, as he's obsessed with American history. I don't know if you ever listened to my podcast. A lot of episodes, my dad jumps in, and he's the reason I got into history. And he watched this program. It's called North and South, and it's about the American Civil War. And I've been watching it, and I find it amazing. And what I find really strange is from watching that, I mean, it goes from sort of around the 1840s all the way up to 1861, and then sort of into the Civil War. But I find it fascinating because what I'm understanding at this time in American history.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There is a huge north-south divide where a lot of people in the north are completely against the slavery. I mean, the British abolished slavery in the early 1800s. We fought wars to prevent slavery across the world. And I think a lot of north of America, because Britain still had ties in Canada, I think a lot of North America was starting to come alongside with the British and say, no, this is an abhorrent part of our history, and we need to get rid of this. And I think in that aspect, I'm noticing a lot of difference between the North and the South divide and how the Civil War was founded. But I find this fascinating because this we're talking about New York here, and essentially this prison is slave labor. And I find that fascinating that the North of America, even in the 1840s, would have. They would have had that divide. There would have been many, many people in the North that were completely against slavery, complete abolitionists. And were they aware that this was going on their doorstep?
Oh, absolutely, they were. And a great example of that is William Henry Seward. William Henry Seward was the former governor of New York State, and he was an avowed abolitionist at certain points in his life. He vacillated at certain points, but by the 1840s, he was a self-identified abolitionist. And he became Freeman's defense lawyer. He took the case pro bono. He defended Freeman in court, but he defended Freeman in court by making a racist argument, claiming that Freeman did what he did because of race and completely silencing his critique of prison slavery. So this is a kind of hypocrisy, let's just call it hypocrisy, that William Henry Seward, who was against slavery, was not against slavery in his own backyard. And William Henry Seward lived less than a mile from the Auburn State Prison. He lived about a 10-minute walk from the Auburn State Prison. So there was prison slavery 10 minutes from his house. He was a major supporter of that form of slavery. And I talk a lot in the book about the specific actions that William Henry Seward took to support prison slavery. And meanwhile, he was against slavery in the South. So this was a kind of doublethink where these two kinds of slavery had nothing to do with each other. And Southern slavery had nothing to do with Northern practices of carceral slavery
I mean,
in their minds. Of
yeah, I
course, it
mean,
had a lot to do with it.
yeah, it did. I mean, William Henry, I recognize that name, and something's telling me he had something to do with Abraham Lincoln's government. But that's where I'm
Yes.
getting the name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, again, I've done episodes on the American Civil War, the abolishment of slavery, And I make a point in one of my episodes saying that Lincoln had no real love lost for slavery. He basically didn't want to expand it. He didn't want to get rid of it. He didn't want to expand it. Now we're talking about the amendment that he put in, the Emancipation Proclamation. And I believe, you can correct me here if I'm wrong, but I believe even in that, it does state that you can have slavery if people are incarcerated to a certain
Yeah, you're
extent.
talking about the 13th Amendment to the
Yes.
US Constitution. And it's not in the Emancipation Proclamation,
Oh,
but it
sorry.
is in the 13th Amendment to the US Constitution. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the 13th Amendment to the Constitution states that involuntary servitude and slavery are illegal in the United States, except, quote, except as a punishment for crime. And in the eyes of a lot of people today, that a lot of people today understand the 13th Amendment, what they call that loophole, as allowing for a new form of slavery, slavery by another name, to form after the South had, after slavery had been abolished in the South. But basically, this was a way for Southerners to re-enslave African Americans after the abolition of Southern slavery. Now that's true, insofar as in white Southerners did use the 13th Amendment to re-enslave African Americans after abolition.
Yeah.
However, what's really important to understand is that the 13th Amendment did not enable a new form of slavery. What the 13th Amendment did was allow the old form of slavery, that is to say, the Northern practice of carceral slavery, to continue. So it did not invent anything new. It did not allow anything new. What it did was allow something old to continue. And the reason I think this is so important is that when we think about the 13th Amendment as creating something new for the South, when we start the story of prison slavery with the 13th Amendment, the problem with that is we're starting the story in the middle. And when we start the story in the middle, what we inadvertently do is let the North off the hook. So,
Yes.
what I am doing in Freeman's Challenge, the murder that shook America's original prison for profit, is putting the North back on the hook.
Yeah, and I find that absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, when you think about, obviously, and again, I'm coming at this from across the pond. When we talk about slavery, and when we look at America and what we're taught in school, because we're probably taught very differently to what you guys are. But when we're taught about slavery, it's very, very focused on the South. You know, it's those 13 or 11 states in the South. They were the bad ones, and we were taught that. And the 13th Amendment, and obviously the abolishment of slavery, we're taught little bits about that, but not a huge amount. And again, it does put a lot of the emphasis on those southern states. So it's quite nice to see that obviously it wasn't just them. And you know, this prison for profit thing, I mean, the fact that it still goes on today is quite shocking. I mean, I find that, you know, you're talking what, 260, 270 years ago, a man, 170 years ago, sorry, a man saying that this is wrong, and yet it's still in practice now.
Yeah, it's absolutely still in practice. The Auburn State Prison still exists. It is now called the Auburn Correctional Facility. It is now the oldest continually operating maximum security prison in the United States, and it is still a site of factory work. So it is still a site of manufacturing. And today, what the Auburn Correctional Facility is best known for manufacturing is license plates. All New York State license plates, 100% of them, are manufactured in the Auburn prison. They are manufactured by men who are literally walking in William Freeman's footsteps.
Slightly better conditions now, I'd hope, though.
Different conditions.
Yeah.
One thing that is the same as in William Freeman's day is that the prisoners have no choice about whether to work or not. So, and this was something really important to William Freeman. He felt that he should have the choice whether to work or not. He should not be forced to work, that was one of the hallmarks of slavery. So this is really important. And actually, right now, literally right now, there is legislation under consideration in New York State. There's an act called the No Slavery in New York Act. It just passed the Senate, and now it has to pass the Assembly in New York State. And what this act says is that prisoners cannot be forced to work. It does not say they don't have the option of working. Nobody wants to take away the option of working. But what this act says very simply is that nobody should be forced to work against their will if they choose not to. And this is under consideration right now, and it's getting a lot of pushback. It is not at all certain that it will pass the assembly. And even if it does pass the assembly, it has to go to voters. So this act, which in my mind is the least controversial thing in the world, it is enormously controversial, and there are a lot of people still in New York State, inside and outside of the government, who support the idea that prisoners should be have no choice about whether or how much to work.
See, again, I find that very, very strange because, like I said, we don't have that type of thing in this country. We our prisons are mainly set on reformation and teaching. So a lot of our prisons have people go in, teach classes, so they can come out with some sort of qualification, so they can blend back into society. I am very skeptical when it comes to that. I mean, I believe me and you would probably have a slightly different opinion because I believe personally, I believe if you commit a crime, I believe your a lot of your rights should be taken away. And I do to an extent understand that you shouldn't have a choice in working, but I do believe that you shouldn't be forced to work for no for nothing. And in this instance, we're talking about a man who was forced to work, and he came out of prison with $2. And that to me is completely wrong. We have jobs in our prisons in this country, and a lot of our prisoners, I believe you have certain jobs pay better. So there are, and obviously the better behaved prisoners get the better jobs. And the that sort of thing in this country. So I don't know what it exactly is in America, but I find that there should be some form of structure to a prison, and getting up, going to work every day is a form of structure. But when we're talking about, like you said, on the 13th Amendment, the fact that these guys, you're allowed to essentially, even now, you're allowed to use slavery in your prison systems, it's shocking. There should not be a thing as slave labor in the modern world. If
I
you've
know we
committed a
should
crime,
be shocked.
yeah, and if you're allowed to work in a prison, which I believe they should, they should get paid for their work. I'm not expecting these guys to be
Absolutely.
on $10, $15 an hour, but they should get something because they are contributing to society, whether they have committed a crime or not.
Absolutely. And that's why the No Slavery in New York Act has been paired with a second act, which is called the Fairness and Opportunity Act. And that addresses exactly the issue that you're describing right now. The Fairness and Opportunity Act states that when prisoners choose to work in New York State, they will be paid fairly, and they also will have access to certain economic rights. So, for example, you and I, as non-incarcerated people, if we save up a little money and we want to put it in a bank account and earn a little bit of interest on it, you and I have the right to do that. People in prison do not, in New York State, have the right to earn interest on their savings. Why not? Why shouldn't they? So, and speaking to your issue about rehabilitation, wouldn't that actually be an incredibly positive thing?
Absolutely.
So that's what the Fairness and Opportunity Act is addressing, not only the right to choose not to work, but also the conditions under which people might choose to work.
Yeah, and I can understand that. Maybe we don't differ too much then. I can totally see your side of the point with that. I mean, this story is very, very fascinating. I know I got sent a copy of it. It's something I'm gonna have to read in my own time because it's sent through like a PDF system. But I find it absolutely fascinating. I find that the historical context from the fact that you're talking about a state, or not just a state, but the entire continent of North America that was hiding black on white violence, that was hiding those crimes from the people, and then this story sort of explodes onto the scene.
Wait, I'm not sure what you mean by hiding black on white violence. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, you're saying that this, obviously the Othello thing and trying to not put it into the public view so people
Right.
won't.
Well, that's more about fiction. That's
Right,
about white
okay.
Americans being afraid of certain images. I mean, Othello is
Right.
fiction.
Yeah, no.
So that's really important to say.
Yeah, or well, this story obviously being a footnote though, so it wasn't publicized in the, or was it? Was it publicized? I mean, was it a massive case at the time?
Oh, it was a massive case in 1846. When this case went to
Right.
trial in 1846, it made national news. It was called the Trial of the Half Century. It made
Wow.
headlines across the United States. It was massive news. And that's in part why it's so important. It's so important because these racist ideas that were articulated by William Henry Seward and also by the prosecutor, who was John Van Buren, who was the son of former President Martin Van Buren, these very
Yeah.
famous people were the prosecution and the defense in this case. And they were making these racist arguments that were then being amplified across the United States. So this was a huge case in
Wow.
its time, but it has been inappropriately, I would say, forgotten. So what I'm really doing is taking this case that was extremely well known at the time, very spectacular at the time, but has been forgotten over 170
Yeah.
years. And what I'm doing is I'm restoring it to its prominence that I think it should have.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree. I think it should. And I find this, I mean, you probably find it yourself as well. There are so many little things like this in history that are so prominent and so important for people to actually pay attention to. And they're just lost. We don't talk about them, or they're not PC, or they don't fit the narrative, and they're hidden from our history. And this story is fascinating. There is obviously more I need to read into this because obviously I think on a couple of points I may have hit, missed my mark on it. But if people want to go out and get the book, I mean you've written a couple of books, but this is the newest one, isn't it?
Yes.
So where can we get this? I mean obviously a lot of my listeners are across this side of the pond. So is it something we can pick up in this country, or is it like an online? Where can we get it?
Well, you can get you could get Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit from any online bookseller. I won't name one, but we all know.
Yes, we do.
There are online booksellers, and it is available on both sides of the pond. You can also get it from a brick and mortar bookstore. If they don't happen to have it in, you can ask them to order it. It's totally available in your country.
Brilliant. I mean, I really, really love this story. I mean, there's a lot to it, and there's so much more information that obviously we can go into, but we don't want to give too much away because otherwise, you want to go and buy the book and listen and read through it because the detail in it, the amount of information there is, and I find, like I said, that the fact that your prison systems essentially haven't learned in 170 years.
Yes.
And I find that, I mean, like I said, we across this country to America, we have so many different viewpoints on certain things. There are things that always come up in American debates, and when I watch different things, that there's a lot of things that Americans seem to care about that in this country we just don't see the issue, and I'm sure there's vice versa as well. But this, to me, this is fascinating because the prison system is so different.
Well, I would love it if British readers would pick up this book and see how the American system existed in the past, which is very similar to how it exists in the present, and if it contrasts in useful ways with the British system, and if it makes British readers feel good in comparison to what the Americans are doing, that is only a good thing in my view. So credit where credit is due. If people read my book and decide that the British system is superior, that is just fine with me, and
I
my
wouldn't
book
say
might give
that.
you a sense of pride.
I wouldn't say it's superior. Like I said, when we had that little conversation, I find the length of punishments in this country aren't enough. But then I look at some of your sentences and certain crimes, and you get people sentenced to like 500 years, and I'm like, you might just what's that's not a sentence. They're not going to live that long. That's not a sentence. I mean, my dad, I know we're pushed for time here, but my dad was a police officer, and he always said to me that a prisoner is put in prison with the ability to get out at some point makes them behave. If you take away that ability to ever leave prison, they're not going to behave while they're in there, because they've what's the point? So I do find that a bit, a bit of a contrast. But I do think people should go out and buy this on both sides of the pond. You know, Americans need to be educated a little bit more on their system, and we over here, I think it'd be very interesting to know how we do things, how things are done at the other side. So thank you very much for joining us. I really, really appreciate your time. And
Thank you so much for having me.
no problem. Thank you very much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.